afternoon. I'd like to call the meeting to order. It is 2:32 now, so we'll get started. Is there any public comment this afternoon? Right. I think I counted to 7 in my head, which is usually the rule. 7 seconds. So hearing no public comment, then I'm going to turn it over to Paula for an introduction.
Yes, thank you. Thank you all for being here today. I want to make a quick introduction to Kayla. Kayla Dixon is our CSPDC summer intern, and then she'll be staying on with us for fall and spring as a graduate assistant from JMU's Masters of Public Administration program. She has interned in the city manager's office in the city of Harrisonburg previously, so she's accustomed to local government, but we're going to plug her into all things transit and transportation this summer, so you will be seeing a lot more of her at these meetings.
Nice to meet you guys.
Welcome, Kayla. Thank you.
Next, we have the approval of minutes, which is from the March 12th meeting earlier this year. Is there a motion to approve?
I'll make the motion.
Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you. Is there any discussion? Can we move forward with the vote?
Oh.
All right. All in favor of approval of the minutes?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Motion carries. All right. I think next we are going to have a microtransit feasibility study presentation by Kimberly Horn. Their team is with us virtually today.
There is one virtual attendee and two in person.
Welcome. Welcome with us in person.
Out of the screen, into the room.
All right. Well, it is good to be with you all today. My name is Tyler Madoon. I'm the project manager of the Kimberly Horn team that's been supporting the CSPDC with the Bright Microtransit Feasibility Study. Next slide. So Kimberly Horn, we've obviously worked with the CSPDC quite a bit on transportation planning efforts in the recent years. We've also worked with a lot of transit agencies across Virginia and the nation on studies such as this. So determining the feasibility of microtransit, which is a type of on-demand transportation that a lot of agencies have been considering. Many have implemented, including several here in Virginia. So I'm joined by Zadie and Poonam on the line. Give a chance for them to introduce themselves.
Hey, good afternoon. I'm Zadie Lacey, and I work with Tyler in the Richmond office. Happy to be here.
Yeah, and I'm Swanee Patel. I'm joining virtually. I'll pull my camera off after, so I'll to let y'all focus on the presentation. But I've been working in the transit planning space for a few years now, and helping out on this project and the RFP development.
So today we are going to give an overview of what went into this study and what the outcomes were. We were with you all at the March meeting and also back in November, so some of you may have been part of those previous presentations, but today we'll kind of give a comprehensive overview of what we did and what the outcomes were. So on, next slide. So our scope was to going back to the transit development plan that was adopted and approved for Bright back in 2022. And as part of that plan, there was several service improvements identified. One of those initiatives to look into for the future was microtransit. So this study really came out of the previous planning effort, the TDP, from a few years back. And the intent was to look at if this service were to move ahead, where in the Bright service area would it make most sense? And what are our recommendations or decisions that would need to be made to get this implemented in the future. So we kicked off the study back in October. We met with you all at the November meeting where we gathered input on transportation needs and challenges that helped really inform the study. Over the winter, we did a lot of our analysis, which Zadie will summarize here in a moment. And we're back with you in March where we shared our draft recommendations. Since then, we've put together an overall study report that the CSPDC is reviewing, and here today to present the final study. So microtransit is often of interest to transit agencies, but best practices and lessons learned have shown that it's really important to identify like a clear goal or transportation need that you're trying to address. It is a tool in the transit toolbox, so not appropriate for, you know, all locations everywhere. So the intent of this study was to identify where what areas are most suitable and how could it be advanced. So as part of the study, we identified goals to tie back to. So if this is implemented in the future, we could turn back and evaluate how we're doing against these. And those three goals were to provide a convenient, reliable, and adaptable transit service, expanding transit connections and mobility options in underserved areas, making sure people can access essential destinations, complementing the existing transit routes and feeding people into the system, and prioritizing financially sustainable strategies. So making sure we're making the best use of limited resources for transit. So a little refresher on what microtransit is. It is a form of on-demand public transportation. So it's similar to paratransit, but a few key differences. It's open to the general public often, so there's no, you know, eligibility requirement or application that would be needed. Anyone would be able to use the service. It is on-demand, so customers must book a trip in real time or in advance. A vehicle that's dispatched to that location or service zone would be driven to them. They get on. It is a public transportation service, so customers would be expected to potentially share rides with others along the way before they're dropped off at their destination. And it is more of a kind of community scale service, so like 5 to 15 square miles is a typical zone size, and a bit more flexible to people's travel needs rather than a fixed bus, which has a predefined schedule and a route that only comes, say, every hour. So this is a little bit more responsive to people's needs for more kind of local trips. And if they're wanting to make more regional trips, they'd be able to take this service to a bus stop where they can board a Bright bus and travel the rest of the system. There's a couple of examples here in Virginia. Several agencies over the past few years have piloted or implemented this type of service. There's examples here from Winchester, Virginia, Charlottesville, Richmond, Prince William County up in Northern Virginia, Montgomery County, Maryland, and Mecco over in Wise in Norton, Virginia. So several examples and great lessons learned from other agencies that can be used as this is considered for the future. That's the Zadie.
Great. So microtransit operates using opportunity zones. These are geographically defined areas that folks can get trips within from one point in the zone to another point in the same zone, or they can connect to external nodes, which would be, you know, locations of regional significance that they could either request a trip from and connect to the zone, or go from the zone and connect to that node. I'll get into that a little bit more. We identified several different zones, and the way that we did that was we looked at a couple different factors. The first was we looked at where the density of jobs and population density and job density was in Augusta County. We also looked at where transit need was already, and we also looked at where people were traveling to already, you know, where those existing travel patterns are in the area. So, trying to find areas where people want to go and where they're already traveling using other modes. Additionally, we also looked at the existing bus service performance. So if there are routes that could be supplemented by microtransit, or in some cases if it would be more lucrative in the future to like maybe replace even like a leg of a microtransit or a fixed route, we looked at those areas as well. So next, I'd like to talk about the zones that we identified. So through this analysis, we identified 7 total zones. These are all areas that are viable and suitable for microtransit based on some of the metrics we just discussed. All 7 are viable. We did want to go ahead and complete a scoring process to evaluate, you know, which in the short term, what would be like the most viable zones to pursue given available funding. So the 4 zones that we focused on first were the North Stanton Zone, the South Waynesboro Zone, the Fishersville Zone, and the Stewart's Draft Zone. You can see the other 3 zones that we also looked at were the South Stanton Zone, the North Waynesboro Zone, and the Greenville Zone.
So one thing I'd like to note is that the Stewartsville zone, the Stewartstrap zone, and the South Stanton zone scored very similarly in our evaluation. But we wanted to focus on the Stewartstrap zone because of its because of the existing service running through Stewartstrap currently, and the ability that microtransit could have in the short term to improve service in the area. We also, I think it's time to move on to the zones. Thank you.
Sadie, so, do you mind speaking up just a little
bit? Of course, yes, thank you so much.
I'm not following you, you're talking so fast and so slowly, I'm sorry.
Oh, I'd be happy to go back if... Sure. Thank you for the reminder. So to evaluate all seven zones, we went through a process of looking at each of the metrics above. So we looked at the transit need in the area, you know, where folks may be needing transit, where it isn't already, or where they may have limited access to the current service. We also looked at transit potential, so where there are a concentration of jobs and where people are living, where they could benefit from some transit. We also looked at trip generators. These are points of interest or areas where we anticipate people wanting to request rides to and from. We also looked at where areas where there could be a potential connection to the existing service that Bright offers, and then we also looked at areas that are not already served as part of that. Additional considerations we made were to look at what the annual cost would be for these zones. We also took into account the conversations we've had here with you all previously and some points of interest that are on your priority list. And we also took into account the performance of the potential route replacement. So it's, yeah. So of the four zones that we discussed prioritizing, looking at first, the first one is the North Stanton zone. So this would begin in northern Stanton, and you could see it has a connection to the current services already in downtown Stanton. And you can see here, there is a point, an external node to the Stanton hub that would be right outside of the zone. So you would be able to connect to many different services from the zone, to and from the zone. Then it moves up the zone, focuses around the I-81 corridor from the North Stanton, focusing on areas like CVS, the Willowview Apartments, moving up the corridor through Mill Place Commerce Park, the Augusta County Government Center, the Food Line, the Dollar General, all the way through Fort Defiance, where it would cross by the high school, and then up through Weir's Cave, covering BRCC and the Dollar General and the airport. So there could be a potential replacement or supplement for the current BRCC services. Next, we looked at the South Waynesboro zone, and the zone focuses around southern Waynesboro, so it would cover the circulator service in Waynesboro, and moving down the Mount Torrey corridor down to Sherando, you would have a connection from Sherando all the way through up north through the Future Nature's Crossing Technology Center, the Future North Oak Grumman Center, the Waynesboro Town Center, Martin's, Walmart, and several other locations. Okay, I'm ready to move on. And then the other two zones that we see would be viable candidates for initial implementation would be the Fishersville Zone and the Stewartstrap Zone. So the Fishersville Zone would focus around this 250 and I-64 corridor, going down to the Amazon facility, and then up through covering Augusta Health, the Library, Food Lion, and WWRC. And next, the Stewartstrap Zone would mostly focus on the Stewartstrap area and would cover areas like McKee Foods, the Target Distribution Center, the Hershey Center, the Food Lion, Augusta Health, the Dollar General, and several different schools, and the Shenandoah Valley Estates, just to name a few locations. And the Stewartstrap Zone would also, sorry, thank you. So this zone also has a potential, as I mentioned before, for a potential replacement later on, and this would offer a potential offset of costs for the fixed route, or it would also be able to supplement the fixed route. I'm going to hand it back to Tyler.
Yeah, so recommendation would be coming out of this study to start with one zone. So it's common for agencies to kind of do these studies to figure out viable options like we did. But then to really kind of choose and narrow in on one to test first and see how that goes, see how riders respond before deciding to continue with that or to expand to other areas. So as part of our recommendations, that was one of the outcomes, was to advance in the future with one of these four. As Zadie said, all the seven that were identified through the data analysis would be options, but these would be the four that we recommend, picking one of them to have the most success in the near term. As part of the recommendations, we also came up with service plans for each of those four. So hours of service, when it would run, times that customers should expect to wait after booking a trip, and that was roughly 20 to 30 minutes. Service hours would be set at 6:30 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. is what we're suggesting, and that would provide options to connect to the other fixed routes in the areas if they're wanting to travel beyond those local zones. We also calculated, you know, estimated ridership, annual costs, how many vehicles would be needed, and a lot of those vary based on the expected demand of the zone and how many vehicles you require to, you know, serve customers in that 20 to 30 minute wait time. For the smaller zones like Fishersville and Stewart's Draft, we're estimating two vehicles being needed. Waynesboro would need three, and then North Stanton, being kind of that larger, longer zone, would need three to four. So that is another consideration in terms of, you know, how to advance is that kind of capital need for vehicles. Next slide. So as part of the study report, we'll have projections for ridership, for costs for each of these four priority zones. Our highest ridership projections were for North Stanton and South Waynesboro, given the amount of kind of larger trip generators those would serve, roughly 100 to 150 riders per day. And then Fishersville and Stewart's Draft, there's ranges there. Fishersville, 55 to 80 riders per day. Stewart's Draft, 85 to 120 riders a day. Just for context, the Stewart's Draft link carries probably 30 to 50 riders a day, I think, on average. So a little bit higher ridership total we're projecting, just because of the ability to extend further into more of the community and residential areas rather than having to stick on the main roads like the Stewart's Draft link or the 250 connector does today. We've also got estimates of costs, cost projections that'll be included in the study. What's shown here is for weekdays, and as Zadie said, fares, kind of adjustments to fixed route or other investment would be needed to kind of support this in the future if decide to move ahead.
Tyler, how did you get your ridership projections?
Yeah, so we looked at some of the travel pattern data that Zadie mentioned. So looking at, it uses cell phone, anonymized cell phone data for how people are traveling in a region, and looking at the current mode share of transit. So that's, I think, about 0.5% or so for this region, if I recall. So some assumptions around like capturing existing trips that people are already taking.
Okay.
We also considered the amount of people that would transfer to a Bright Bus if they were needing to travel beyond the zone. So it was kind of looking at different data sources, that current travel pattern data, making some assumptions about mode share based on what we experience today in transit in the region, and then looking at performance of similar routes that are operating in these areas.
The reason why I ask is for example, in Fishersville right now, or the hospital, we have to utilize outside resources for transportation to and from the hospital, whereas if we had other viable options, we may choose a different rideshare. And so we spend quite a large volume of resources, financial resources, on an annualized basis, providing transportation to patients who don't have who have transportation barriers to and from the hospital, whether that be for appointments or they need to get home from the emergency room and they have no way to do that. And I didn't know if that was calculated in the Fishersville ridership.
So it could be as part of that existing data, but if there's like specialized uses or large generators, that would, you know, could play into seeing higher numbers than this. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. So as part of the study, we also looked at different approaches to delivering the service. So there's, with MicroTransit, a technology piece. So there's a customer app, there's a driver app, so that they're connected with customers as they're requesting trips. There's the back-end software for scheduling the service, and for the agency to report, you know, performance. And so the technology is one component of the service delivery. And then there's the day-to-day operations, so getting service on the street, the drivers, the vehicles. And so there's a couple different approaches we looked at. The first is called software as a service. So that is where an agency operates in-house with its own drivers, its own vehicles, but contracts out for that scheduling software piece and pays technology fees on a recurring basis. That's very different than how Bright operates today, but we did want to just do a full evaluation. The second one is turnkey. So that would be where a contractor is responsible for providing the drivers, the vehicles, the technology that's needed. And that's similar to how Bright operates today. And the third approach is hybrid. So you still have a contractor that's running the service, but the agency may contract separately to get the technology that the contractor would use. So we looked at a bunch of different factors of, you know, how well that fits within the current model, you know, the ease of implementation, and came to the recommendation that a turnkey approach would be recommended. So that what that would look like in the future is likely when the agency would go to implement MicroTransit, an amendment to the service contract that is used to provide Bright services today, to have that future contractor provide MicroTransit as well. There's a couple different fleet options and vehicle types that we looked at. We saw several of these examples earlier in those Virginia services that operate today. There's kind of a range of using cutaways, which is similar to how Bright operates today, Sprinter vans, which are a little bit smaller vehicles, 7 to 11 passengers, and then minivans. So those are least capacity, 2 to 6 passengers. Most agencies that we've seen have used the Sprinter van. Agencies that want to kind of quickly implement something using their existing fleet have opted to use cutaways, since they can kind of repurpose a paratransit vehicle, for example. So we are suggesting one of those two options. The Sprinter van would be kind of the most flexible for, you know, capacity of being able to, you know, have multiple passengers share their trip at once, but also being a little bit smaller to be able to navigate, you know, driveways, easier or difficult to drive roadways, places where typical transit buses may have trouble serving. For booking and payment, we have a few recommendations here. Booking methods, customers would be able to book on demand in real time by calling or by using the mobile app that would be deployed as part of this. So people that are less technology savvy or prefer to call would still have that option. They'd be able to book a trip in real time. So again, needing to travel, calling up the service in that 20 to 30 minute window, getting a trip. Or they could schedule in advance. So if you knew you had a medical appointment or something coming up in the next 2 weeks, having that option to allow advanced scheduling. We wouldn't allow hop-on trips or kind of flag downs. Customers would be expected to kind of book their trip in advance. On payments, we would suggest offering the same methods that Bright has today, so cash, punch cards, but with the technology, there'd be an ability to pay within the app as well if you're booking that way. So that would allow credit and debit card payments, and also potentially voucher codes. So what we've seen other agencies have the ability to do if they're partnering with human services or social services organizations or agencies that want to subsidize or provide trips, customers could be provided like a promo code that they would be able to enter when they reserve their trip to get credit towards that trip. Recommended fare is $1 per trip is what we are suggesting. We looked at peer agencies. That would be in line with many of the paratransit trips. But are suggesting a reduced fare program similar to what Bright operates today for certain passengers. A lesson learned of many other agencies and a key to success is outreach and engagement. So as part of the plan and recommendations, we have outlined a lot of different strategies that could be used to educate the community about what this service is, how to use it. So have different timelines included about, you know, initial engagement, working with stakeholders such as you all, such as the business community, libraries, other community organizations, to begin to get the message out, gather input from the public before any service changes are made. Leading up to launch, there is kind of an education and engagement campaign to kind of boost awareness about this service. During launch, many agencies have boots on the ground, people riding along to kind of educate people on how to use the service, travel training. A lot of that on-the-ground outreach is really important to success. And then post-implementation, there's kind of continuous marketing, advertisement engagement that's often important to kind of continuing to build ridership and attract people to use the service. So, to summarize, the study, we kind of looked across the board at areas where this type of on-demand service would make sense in the Bright service area, different steps that would be needed to get that implemented in the future, several recommendations around service delivery model, fares, engagement. So really, the plan is kind of a tool for the CSPDC and its partners to use after this to make some decisions about how to advance. We intended to, you know, provide options and make it as flexible as possible, given that a lot of this is dependent on funding and funding partners. So the plan will have, you know, different kind of a menu of options to choose from. If this were to advance, it's typically about a 12-month process to kind of get things up and going. And we'd recommend piloting an initial zone for 18 to 24 months. It typically takes a bit of time for customers to get familiar with the service, adopt it, to really be able to evaluate it if it is effective and makes sense to continue beyond that. So kind of steps to implementation would be to select one of those four zones to do an initial pilot, to secure funding partners, to develop that engagement plan and begin to conduct that outreach. If moving ahead with a turnkey approach, the service contract would need to be amended to require that contractor to provide the service in the future. The CSPDC would still have the ability to write, you know, requirements of what the service needs to do, any features that the technology is expected to have, so there'd still be a way to kind of guide that implementation even with a contractor. And then finalize service design in partnership with that contractor, the exact zone boundaries, hours of service, fare, all those decisions would need to be finalized before launching the service. So that really concludes. We kind of came to the conclusion that this is, you know, an opportunity for some modernization, some expansion of transit connections in the future, identified a couple viable areas where this could make sense, and really just provided options and information to make some decisions in the future. But open it up for any questions or comments if anyone has any.
Three vehicle options that you mentioned, would all three of those provide accessibility, even the minivan?
That would be a requirement to have ADA accessibility regardless of the vehicle, just so that, you know, response is the same for everyone.
Kind of related, have the other jurisdictions that have used those, do those typically have any bike racks on them?
Yes, some have elected to add bike racks. I think that could be an option. Because there could be people that may want to, you know, use that for their last connection or to have flexibility during the day.
And if for that 18 to 24 month pilot period, do you recommend that if there's a fixed route with that microtransit area that we keep the fixed route during that pilot time period?
It would, I guess, kind of depend on the zone. So the only two that we identified kind of more substantial changes that could happen to fixed route would be Stewart's Draft. I think that could be a candidate for a full replacement, given that you'd be able to make just about all the same connections that exist today. The BRCC with the North Stanton zone, that would likely need to, you know, still remain, but there could be opportunities to maybe run more express from Stanton up to BRCC and use microtransit for local trips like in Verona or Augusta County. So there might be potential adjustments to the schedule of the BRC shuttle in the future to kind of get more, get up there more express and use microtransit for more of the local trips along the way. So we've seen a bit of both. Some agencies like to keep both in place just to see, gather some data about what customers prefer, but then there's the cost, you know, factor as well, where you've got to make some decisions and trade-offs. Yeah.
Thank you.
With the other peer agencies, do they typically start out with the pilot program as the starting point? And does that often, I guess, what's the success rate, and does that often transition into like a permanent service, or does that translate also into expanding into other zones?
Yeah, so with microtransit, as part of the recommendations, we also included some suggestions for performance measurement and factors like that that could be monitored. And compared to traditional transit, it takes a bit more attention and monitoring of how the service is doing, and being adaptable is what we've heard from other agencies. There's a lot of value in, you know, getting into the data weekly and to see how people are responding to the service. And many of the agencies that have piloted have, you know, been flexible in that pilot period, maybe making adjustments to the boundaries of where the zone is or the service hours as they kind of see how people are using the service. So even during that pilot period, we've seen people, you know, be adaptable and flexible and maybe make some tweaks to the service as they learn how people will use it. And then many agencies do choose to kind of implement some permanent service, but I think they learn a lot during that initial pilot and maybe pivot to maybe consider other types of locations. We've kind of seen the spectrum of, yeah, how people advance forward. I guess one thing to note with pilot, we did, I guess from a public perception, it's, you don't want to give the impression that the service isn't going to be there in the future, and that's always a challenge about putting something out without, you know, certainty of how it will continue. So just about the messaging and branding, I guess there's a piece of that to consider as well. You know, people might be hesitant to try a new service if they think it's just something temporary or that's not going to be there in the future to serve their needs.
Sure.
Yeah.
So is that kind of uncertainty about kind of what happens after the pilot is over, is that workable in terms of the contracts that, the new contract that's going to happen, like, is there, would it just have to be amended then after the pilot, or how do you foresee that happening?
You mean if it were to not continue?
Or if it continued, but at including the rest of the zones, like, would that be written into the contract right away, that like after 2 years it's going to be expanded, or there would be a contingency that like, how would that?
Yeah, I think it would probably be posed as this is a pilot first, and then we have the opportunity to write amendments to our contracts all the time. Like when we added the Afton Express, that was an amendment, and we've made several changes to the Afton Express as it's grown. So yeah, we have that ability within our contract structure to issue an amendment to do something incrementally, and then if that works out well and we want to continue to expand that, to just continue to build on that. So we wouldn't have to go all chips in at the very beginning for contract purposes.
Okay, yeah, that's kind of what I was wondering. And then as far as, are there any examples where the transit, the sort of standard transit provider and the provider of the microtransit and technology are different?
Yes.
Or is it assumed that, because I mean that you were kind of talking like it's assumed that that's the same company, but I don't know if.
So in those three approaches, we had a third one that we called hybrid. So
but that was like the technology and the operator being different, right? I'm talking about like
the other services.
Yeah,
and this service being different. We have seen that in some agencies, yeah. Typically, I guess, Poonam, if you recall, I know we looked at a bunch of other ones. About the question was agencies that may have one contractor for their fixed route or paratransit and then choose to have another one for microtransit.
Yeah, I've seen that more so with like agencies that have like ASIC. Sorry, I think you can see me now. Where they do have some agency operations handled in-house, but and then have separately contracted microtransit. I think it's very dependent on how your existing operations are and then what your staff capacity is. I think that when we were doing the evaluation, one thing that we considered was ease of interoperability. I think there's some component of having the same contractor for all services that might be easier to bring on microtransit, but we've definitely seen the full gamut of contracting approaches.
Yeah, with that, with one contractor, there could be efficiencies with like vehicle use and even commingling of trips. So that vehicle could, you know, sort of paratransit during some times of the day, microtransit during others. So there's a little bit more flexibility, I think, having it all within one provider.
One of the things that we learned from peer agencies, DRPT actually released a microtransit kind of pilot report a few years ago with two agencies in the state, and one of the agencies really emphasized how important it was for them to have their microtransit branded as the same as their fixed route, because they do work in an area with a lot of senior citizens and a lot of people who don't have exposure to transit other than working through them. So that brand name recognition was trusted, they understood what it was more easily, and the communications and ability to get people comfortable with using that new service was an easier task than if it were something solo branded or operated, you know, separately. There was that continuity, and that's something that we pegged as being important, particularly in our region as well.
Makes sense.
But yeah, it was super catchy and fun, because I noticed there was a lot of great names that the other organizations.
I think we've already been kicking around.
I was going to say, does that come with part of the recommendation? Because I was looking for that and never got that slide. So
before Bonnie retired, she dibbed it the bright light or light bright. So
I would think it would make sense in several ways as far as managing, especially elderly people who are not used to using Bright. They would still be using phone calls, and you'd still need people to coordinate. So it seemed like one source would make sense.
Is there a recommendation that's being proposed for consideration today?
Yes, so Tyler and company have drafted the executive summary along with the final report. So Danielle and I are reviewing that currently. So once it's been finalized, we'll send it out to you all, and you can have to share with your respective organizations, jurisdictions for review. And then timeline-wise, we'll probably get through the new contract first before we would try to implement anything new. So we would just have this on the back burner. Part of the RFP will be to have a little addendum saying that potential growth includes microtransit and kind of the fleet recommendations and everything else that was recommended in the study, just as a baseline for them to have to know that this is something that we're looking forward to.
So stay tuned.
Yes, stay tuned.
I guess one curiosity I have would be, is there data about, you mentioned in one of your earlier slides that reaching unserved or underserved populations is one of the benefits of microtransit. Is there data to tell us what that impact is on, because paratransit was a game changer for individuals with disabilities. Is this the next game changer for individuals that are typically unserved or underserved?
Yeah, I think a lot of the benefits we've seen come around like the responsiveness and flexibility. So if you're not able to get to a bus stop, like this is a little bit more responsive to getting to where you are or where you need to travel to. That may be in, you know, harder to reach areas. So there's a benefit there about, yeah, just kind of coverage and of additional areas to make transit accessible. And then that kind of wait time, many of the routes today run, I think, on hour schedules or so 20 to 30 minutes potentially having a ride there rather than having to wait that half hour. That responsiveness is another benefit. But there's different ways to measure that. We've got some like performance measures in the study about some of those and some of the financial cost efficiency, things like that. So kind of that, a lot of different ways to look at success, but we've outlined a couple different ways.
Tyler, do you know off the top of your head with the zones, if any of them, how they overlay on the existing 3/4 mile service radius for paratransit for some of those zones? Would any of those zones extend service beyond what that 3/4 mile of a fixed route currently provides?
We can look at that, but I think I would suspect, yes, there would be further reach beyond a 3/4 mile, so even more areas that would be accessible. We'll note, like, some agencies have found some paratransit customers switching to microtransit if they're able to do that, it works for them. So that's another, I guess, benefit to be a little bit more responsive for those trips too. But yeah, we can take a look to see what that additional like reach would be beyond the 3/4 mile.
It's always really challenging when we get a request for a paratransit trip and they're like, you know, a few blocks away from that 3/4 mile cutoff. And we're like, our vehicles could probably get there in the same amount of time, but that's just not how the system is structured. So I could see that as being an opportunity for folks who might be able and might be eligible through ADA to access paratransit, but it currently does not serve far enough off the route to get to them.
So you have to be off the up to 3/4 of a mile, is that correct?
For the current paratransit service, it only serves 3/4 of a mile from a fixed route.
Oh, okay. Oh, I'm barely there.
That's a little scary.
We're glad you are.
I must
Don't
be.
Move your house at all.
But I think to your point, Mike, I mean, when we live in a county that's the size of a state, there's just so many folks that have access issues, right? And it's constantly a challenge for all of us. And you know, and I know at Augusta Health, we looked at contracting with something like Uber Health or Lyft Health. And the thing is, there's just not the volume of drivers that's ever gonna be able to support that even if we contracted with that. So opportunities like this are so exciting. I think we're gonna have to move in that direction to be able to serve our community and the needs that we all have. And those are just gonna continue to grow as our population ages.
If you're talking lower cost, lower income, you know, difficulties out in the county, they're gonna, the dollar is gonna, that's another challenge.
Absolutely.
So.
All important things to consider.
Yeah. Well, I think a dollar certainly seems reasonable.
Yeah, and so, yeah, nothing's set in stone. That's an important, you know, reminder. There's still opportunity as if this were to move to implementation, there's typically a step once there's a contractor on board, once you're getting ready to launch, to kind of refine some of the recommendations from here. So there could be another look at fares or, again, the boundaries of, you know, what's here as a plan. It's not meant to be, you know, set in stone. So there's flexibility as we get closer to implementation. We know things change and priorities may change a little bit over the next few years. Right. Thank you all. If you have any other questions or follow-up as you, you know, get the report or review any of that, feel free to get in touch with Devin and Danielle, and they'll pass that feedback on to us.
Thank you all. Thank you all for joining us virtually. virtually. Not virtually, in person. Thank you for joining us virtually. We are going to move
Thank you.
On. To the Afton Express update. Danielle, I think, has that today.
Yes, thank you.
Awesome.
We are really taking a hard look at the Afton Express schedule, a deep dive, as we continue to see ridership increase. We have an increase in demand, and we're planning on adding that extra trip in the near future. So we are taking a look at the schedule. The current one was created pre-COVID. And as we kind of looked at in the last meeting, when we looked at the annual Afton Express report and survey, we saw that some trips have more usage and utilization than other trips. Also, we do get some requests for certain times that we don't serve exactly. So all set to say, we really need to look at the schedule and make sure it's the most really effective and efficient schedule it can be. So we have brought on board one of our consultants, WRA, to take a look at the schedule. They'll be looking at start and end times for large employers, our current ridership, stop usage, trip usage, what times are most utilized, and really compare all this to those popular employee start and end times. So really fine-tuning our arrival and departure times. And I'll also be making sure that we're utilizing our fleet in the best way possible. And we want a schedule that can, you know, gives ridership room to grow, but also doesn't alienate our current ridership. So we have had our kickoff meeting with WRA. They're currently combing through a lot of data, a lot of information, and this is a fast-tracked project. We hope to have a draft of a schedule to you all by our next meeting. And if that all goes well, it'll go out for public comment for that 21-day period. And if that all goes well, we hope to have this up and running and live by the fall. We're aiming for September. As we all know, the bulk of our riders are UVA affiliated, so many work within that higher education calendar and timeline. We do see an increase in ridership in the fall and really a spike in new ridership during the fall. A lot of people are starting new habits, trying new things at the start of that academic year, so it's a really good time to kick off a new schedule. So we've set a lofty goal with this timeline, but we are moving forward on it. We're really excited about it, and we'll keep you all posted and hopefully have something exciting to show you at the next meeting. That's really the only update on that now, but I'm happy to answer any questions on that.
Thank you, Danielle. Steve, I think you have a contract update about general operations and then the 250 connector as well.
Oh, just roll from one night to the other. So we are actively pursuing drivers, not to the point where we're pulling people off the street, but you never know. So, and the Afton Express and Bright together, we've had a modest increase in ridership, and we haven't really gotten back to the pre-COVID numbers, but we're closing in on it. You know, it was a wide gulf there for a while, so it's closing in on that. Like I said, staffing, we're actively seeking drivers, trying to pull some school bus drivers out now. The window for that is shortened. School is starting like the 1st of August somewhere in there, as opposed to later in the month, so there's a small window in there, but it certainly would help, and every now and then one of those folks try to stay with us. Fleet been doing fairly well, most of it's routine, so the shop didn't have anything in there today, so I'm doing well on that front. So everything's going well. The folks we got have been sticking in there with us, and that's all I got on the operation front. It's been pretty quiet and rolling along pretty smooth, so that's all we can ask for.
Plus
he teased
me.
What's that?
Plus
he teased
me.
Yay! That's pretty. Who did that?
It looks, from a rider's perspective, as if you're much busier with paratransit.
It is. You know, it's in different areas. So, yeah, it's a lot in some places. I mean, you know, double digit a lot. And is that a matrix? No. Double digit a lot?
And I will say that for our expansion for this fiscal year 26, we did put in some additional hours on the third paratransit bus, so hopefully that will help with some of the increased usage that the service has been seeing.
Looks necessary. My observation. Experience.
So we're going to talk about the proposed route changes for the 250 connector and the Waynesboro circulator. So, I'm reading the wrong notes here, Kevin. Give me too much paper to work with. So we were looking at Sanger's Lane came on as a partner at Target at times earlier. So that has worked out well going up to the on top of the hill there. And so we're looking at expanding that, which would, affect the 250. it's kind of a hard to wedge stuff in there with your two fixed ends and your fixed time. So part of that was remove the Amazon stop at Waynesville. If any of y'all have been here long enough, that used to be the old Kmart stop, and there are still people that ask for the old Kmart stop. And this would be for the Valley Community Service Board to make it an hourly event. Those buses don't necessarily, it's pretty much the middle point of that, but they don't cross at the same time, but there would certainly be service coming and going from Waynesboro and Stanton up there on an hourly basis. And to facilitate that, we were looking at expanding service in Waynesboro, which is part of a conversation about adding service to West Main. It has been in the past. So we would implement the transit development plan. Traveling on West Main would be part of that. So this all happens around the Lou DeWitt corridor. Right now the 250 comes down and goes past Lou DeWitt and goes through the Amazon area and then comes back out and goes back on Lou DeWitt down to Walmart. And then it comes out and it doesn't end that. So it does that all day till 4:30, 5 o'clock or something to that effect. So we would reroute on Lou DeWitt Boulevard. For the circulator would be that there's a road that runs parallel there, which is Brookerdale. There's some apartments there. It comes up to the backside of where Amazon is and T-Mobile in that corner, if y'all are familiar with that. We would utilize that for the circulator and take us out of that intersection there, which right now currently involves two lights coming through there if you're utilizing that way. And then the reroute would also include moving some stops out to 13th Street, which is in the established route now. So you're right on top of it. The VCSB stops originally proposed to implement service of three times a day, which we are currently doing. We do that at 8 o'clock in the morning, at noon, and then at 5 o'clock. And like I said, that's been going well. Folks have really appreciated that. It would not affect the two stops that are already established down there, which are called the Royal and whatever the motel is there, the Exxon station. So those would still be in the service area and continue to go on. The changes seek to enhance the current operation by making the VCSB a full-time stop. And we wouldn't really set the times now. We would align those with their operational hours, whatever suits them to make that possible is how we would align that. So whatever their close time is, we would certainly work with that. I think 8 o'clock was their original time for opening. So and the current operation, 250 serves the Amazon Waynesboro stop. Like I said, that runs all day, and buses go in there both ways. So it's pretty active as far as coverage from the bus. The proposed operation would have the 250, would not travel to Amazon after that. So that change from people coming from the circulator to the 250 or whatever from that Amazon stop would move to the hub at Waynesboro. So the Waynesboro circulator now travels from Waynesboro, and it travels up the Rosser Avenue, up through Waynesboro. It goes up and crosses Main Street and does a little loop around Walmart, the neighborhood Walmart, and heads out to Hopman Parkway, catches DMV Food Line out there, comes up King Avenue, crosses the Gum, comes back to Florence, goes across Bridge Street, goes over to Social Services, comes back, it goes 4th Street, which everybody knows that's Dave's Market. So it goes by Dave's, comes back out, and heads downtown to West Main. Speedway's out there. It goes through there, goes across it goes across Broad Street, gets on Arch, goes over to Kroger, goes over to the library, and then from the library it goes on Wayne Avenue, goes down to 11th Street, cuts across and comes across Pine. That's part of our proposal too, is to pull that 11th Street and Pine out of there and move it to 13th, kind of stream like that. you could move those stops out there along the way. There are, I don't know, there's four or five stops out there now with intersections. It's almost like every other street is what it looks like if you just glance at it. So, so the Waynesboro would be with Booker Dale. Later on, I'm kind of rambling with y'all because I know y'all are all on the same page. Booker Dale, there's apartments in there. There would probably be an opportunity somewhere in the future after we kind of get this thing nailed down and figured out if we wanted to add a stop in there in the area of the apartments. I think that's it. So after you do those two stops, you'd come back out of Rosser. Times and contender rates, there isn't any safety, timing, anything. I think Booker Dale is a better road than going up and down Lou DeWitt. It also cuts down on confusion. There are 250 stops along Lou DeWitt that would still be out, run off the 250 if we kind of commingle those. By one conversation was to have it go out and loop around the circular, go out and loop around and come back. I think without doing that, it cuts down on some of the confusion and stuff there. The time scenario is a little shorter on the loop scenario is what we call that, as opposed to the out. So there's no safety concerns out there that we could see, some moving of signs. No really timing impacts. You know, you might have to adjust some stuff by a minute or two, but I think that'll be easy. The two scenarios considered developing this proposal were potential new stops and sign locations. So I think if you, some of it is, so 13th Street's an example. There's a stop there at 11th that Arby's, we just moved that around the corner to say the cookout or wherever that is. So it's still within a block. It almost seems like just turning the sign around another way so you can read it over here. So, and like I said, the stops on Pine Street, you could move those out to 13th. It's a block. The Pine Street stop is a block either way from 11th to 12th. So that'd be fairly easy. We gave consideration to the circulation traveling to and from the Amazon stop as opposed to just making the loop, and the loop seemed a better option. There's also some opportunities on West Main for a stop, say in the DuPont Credit Union Sheets area out there. There's what the Budget Inn we identified out there. There's a place out there that we get a lot of calls. Do we service that? And right now we don't. So that would be benefit as well. And there was mileage difference. If you went out from Walmart and then came back to Ross, that's 5 miles to get back out to where you'd be on Main Street as opposed to 3 miles going the just making the loop going out Booker Dale and hitting Main Street. So that was a consideration as well. So I know that was all disconnected, but y'all got any questions? I can drill down into where I lost you.
So yeah, like Steve said, they looked at two different scenarios to kind of see which one best fit. So looking at traveling both Rosser and West Main rather than just West Main, which is what was identified in the transit development plan at the time. So we just compared the two. So it really aligns with the TDP, but also kind of takes into consideration of actual operations. So Steve and his folks did their due diligence on that. So if you all want to move forward with that, we can go for a vote on a motion to approve this change or not. And so once you all would approve that change, because Valley Community Services Board, they are a partial funder for this current fiscal year that we're in. The next fiscal year will start July 1st, and they have said that they will be a full funding partner, so this way that will give them their hourly service and then align. So voting on that today would essentially give us the means to be able to move that forward and start all these changes by July 1st.
I mean, I think it's excellent that we're able to do the full hourly service for Valley. That's been such a need that I'm so glad we're able to meet. So thank you for making that happen. The one question I did have is the Amazon stop, is that the one that helped me remember? Does that serve the UVA Dialysis Center? Is that the stop?
Right there on the corner, so you could.
Okay.
You could. It's right in that vicinity.
Do we feel like, I know that was a big deal when the Dallas Center moved out of the MOB at Augusta Health and patients were no longer able to utilize the stop there. Do we feel like there's going to be a sick, have we analyzed the impact that's going to be on dialysis patients if they're not able to have that Amazon stop and what that's going to look like?
it's really taking the sign from here and putting it right here. So, you know, they'd have to walk that grass. We could, though, within the 3/4 mile, take the bus and pull into that parking lot and come back out. So,
because I know for Dallas's patients, mobility is just such a challenge.
Yeah. So it's
and that would be, I guess, the concern that I would have about the proposed change.
It's a popular ADA stop on the demand.
Okay.
But it certainly could be enhanced and pull some of that off. If people want to do it, it kind of rides outside of the other time, so it'd give them more flexibility to get in and out of there. So, and they can schedule for that as well on the route buses.
Have we communicated well with the dialysis center about how their folks can schedule, their patients can schedule that and promoted that within there? Do you know if we've had conversations with them?
We have. They changed some staff, and they've changed some hours and stuff targeting that, so we've kind of moved around and done that.
Okay, great.
So,
thank
yeah.
you.
So moved.
Thank you.
I don't get to hold my hand up, so yeah, I'll shake my head yes.
Is there a second? All right, are there any other discussion? Or you more move forward with the vote? All right, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Right, you have a vote.
Okay, so yeah, we'll move forward. We'll finalize those stop locations. We will order a bunch of new signs, and we will update the GTFS and Passio updates, as well as the schedule brochures, and do some press releases and postings, and hopefully have that change all set in stone for July 1st rollout.
Thank you.
And Wilf will be excited. He's been talking about this for years to the point that he just quit talking about it.
It's always a win when we can add service without taking service away by shifting it to another route. We did that similarly earlier this year with the trolley and the North and West loops to be able to accommodate Middlebrook Trace. So, you know, major appreciation to BRT for helping us kind of figure out how we can still serve the same places, but maybe in a different way to increase access to everyone.
And they were happy with that going to a full hourly too. It's been.
All right. Is there any other business today? All right. Hearing none, then I guess we will move to adjournment. It is 334. So we will adjourn. Our next meeting is July 9th. Look forward to seeing you all. Thank you all very much. Thank you all.